Andy, it was good to see you last week.
Yeah, that was
in real life.
Exactly. It was actually the first time because you've been in France for nearly 5 years. So even at the other microconfs, I wasn't able to cross paths with you. So it was fun to see you and the family, eat some lobster.
It was great. Yeah, we had, I mean, so just for background, we spent about a week kind of in New England, flew in and saw Matt Medeiros from our team on Monday, and then came up and spent some time in New Hampshire and then in Maine. Just kind of, taking a little vacation of our vacation. And it was great to catch up with you and your wife. And yeah, the food was excellent. And Portland is a beautiful city. So you're very fortunate to live there.
Yeah, no, we've loved it. Which we were just talking about this before we were recording. We haven't really loved how nuts the housing market has gotten. But I think a lot of people all over the country can kind of relate to that. Just limited supply, law of demand. And so it doesn't take a economics major to figure out what's going to happen there. So no, we're still enjoying it, like in our apartment, figuring things out. But yeah, it was a nice little break, and the weather's starting to turn more consistently warm. So it's hard to complain.
Yeah. How's the business going?
It's going well. I mean, there's ups and downs as always, but we're making progress. Matt is going to be coming back from paternity leave, I think kind of next week. He'll be part-time for 3 weeks from there, but like he'll at least be around. And so I don't really see it as though he'll be moving the ball forward much on his own projects, but it's going to just really kind of break through a lot of bottlenecks with developers and the data scientists and all of that, where it's like, I can kind of keep things moving, but once they hit roadblocks, it's like it's been good because the team we have in place has done a really good job of diagnosing issues and figuring out how to fix them. But it just takes probably an order of magnitude longer for them to figure it out. Whereas Matt can just like, oh, check out this, check out that. Like, it's probably because of this. Whereas like they're digging through the code all over the place. So I'm excited for that. We're onboarding this week. Jordan, who is our hire, just kind of calling him a marketing strategist. I didn't want to pigeonhole it in content, but that's primarily what he'll be working on. But it's going to be geared towards a lot of success type of work, which you've talked about, just really taking ownership over educating our customers, our trial users, and figuring out what we need to do to help get them up to speed, help keep them around, and just kind of working with me to just combat churn and all of that. So it's been busy. I'm a little nervous for today because it's like coming up on 18 hours since the second vaccine. So I'm like hoping that I don't deteriorate too much from here because I'm already feeling a little bit slow. But no, things are looking good. How are things going on your end?
Good. Yeah. So I got my second COVID shot Sunday. So like the day after we saw y'all. And yeah, we got it like 7 o'clock in the morning. And by like that night, it was like terrible, just terrible. And the next day, just like, oh my God, I felt stupid, more than normal, like headache and fever and chills, just all the stuff that everybody says. And my wife was telling me, she read an article that like the reason younger people get more sick than older people with the vaccine is because they have a stronger immune system. So your body is kind of fighting that new kind of introduction to the system. So like, I wonder like if they ever try to roll out vaccines for kids, what they will have to do, because like, I mean, my kid, you know, if that's really the thing is like kids don't get COVID or whatever because their immune system is so much stronger, like the vaccine would be a really big deal for them. So I would imagine they'd have to tone that down a little bit.
But kind of more of a calculus around what makes sense there.
Yeah, age or body weight or something like that. So yeah, that was a big part of my week. was just like missing most of Monday and like part of Tuesday from that. I had a question for you on your with Jordan, your content strategy, like your success content strategist kind of guy. One thing, because like Matt on our team fills that role largely, but one thing I was wondering is how will you and he decide what the content strategy or map is there? Like, how do you identify
like the specific pieces, the big picture, kind of all of it? What are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big picture kind of leads into the individual pieces. Right. That's how we try to think, at least. Like, is it like, this is the biggest obstacle, so we need a piece about this, or, you know, every blog post needs a video, you know, or every help doc needs a blog post to accompany it, or like, how do you think about it in general, I guess?
Yeah, so this is a big focus of ours going forward. and really tried to just think more holistically about everything that we're doing, because I still, for our space, that's very niche. There is search traffic, but it's just like not something we could just endlessly publish on unless we were doing content that like truly evaporates at the end of the day, where it's like a lot of our competitors will have podcasts and blog posts and all these things for like the day's games. And that's just like an endless hamster wheel. People do like that content, but we're just resource-wise, I don't think it's the best place for us to invest. And so what, this is going to be a long-winded answer, but I'll try to kind of get to it. So it's what we've done in the past is focus on more evergreen topics around strategy. Some will be about just how to think about daily fantasy sports in general. Some will break down strategies for specific sports. And we've built up like a YouTube library of dozens of videos. We have kind of the pillar content from that also on our site. It's been very helpful, but it's not organized. There's not a clear path for someone to come in and know what to look for. And so, and frankly, the content's been created over a couple of years, so it's not always consistent either. We might have said one thing in one video, and as we've learned and improved, like we've kind of have different takes on it now. And so what I'm trying to do is put together a curriculum where it's won't necessarily be like a school or academy type thing, but it will just be, I guess, more of even like a syllabus where it's like, this is the order of things that you're going to go through. If you're more advanced, you can jump right into these ones. If you're just starting out, start right from the beginning with this. And that will make it easier, I believe, for people to help themselves. And we're going to still promote this content in the right order throughout all of our material and everything. Like in the videos themselves, we'll reference the other videos, but it just gives us a smaller set of higher impact content. And so that's primarily going to be driven by me as far as what goes where and when. But what I'm going to be like, I want Jordan to have input in the process. And I think as it gets down more into the micro details, it'll matter a lot more, because like he is going to be interacting daily with customers, both in the sport inbox, in our Slack community, all of that. And I think he'll be also working with Ross and Chris, who are on our support team, and kind of being the bridge between support and marketing, so that he can say, okay, like we put this content out here, we're still getting questions about this, that, and this. Maybe we should try to rework it in this way. But like that's kind of how I see us working together, is I have a pretty clear vision for what this will look like, and he's going to help me iterate on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that we do a similar approach. Matt is, kind of the bridge between like the customer voice and marketing, not necessarily customer support, because we have someone that is like the voice of the customer from like a bug and product and needs kind of perspective, like feedback perspective, but more on like from a proactive perspective, like, hey, this is what the market is doing and this is what people need. And this is, and even getting into like product stuff that he talks, he and I talk a lot about that as he's kind of just out in the world a little more. Yeah, I think that sounds like a good strategy. And I mean, we a big part of what Matt did when he started was building like a bit educational kind of library. We call it an academy, but I don't think you have to. And then is constantly creating new content that is, kind of marketing and kind of educational. Like it'd be hard to call it just success, but because it is kind of some marketing content.
Because this is something where, I just feel there can be overwhelm. And so it's with on the part of the customers, the consumers of the content, where it's like, I don't actually know how you all organize it, but this was something that we just really struggled with. It was just as we kept producing more, it got harder and harder for people to figure out where to go and what to consume. And it's like, we're also restructuring our knowledge base. And frankly, I haven't found a knowledge base that I really like. From a not in terms of the software, but in terms of how companies set them up. It's like looking at Intercom, looking at ConvertKit, looking at HelpScout, looking at Groove, looking at like all the ones you'd expect. Like it's not that they're bad, but it's just as your product gets more and more complex, it gets so difficult. Like I'll go into getting started and there's 30 things in there. And it's like that's not helpful to anybody. And so this is like the line we're trying to walk, is we want to be well documented. But it doesn't, I feel like knowledge bases are built to display all this content, but as you actually like document everything, they're not useful and everyone is just searching for what they're looking for because they're not organized in a way that's actually helpful. So I think we're trying to simplify things a bit and say, okay, the knowledge base will have product documentation and will have FAQs that kind of are the catch-all for all the things that don't necessarily fit right in there. And then we'll have our strategy guides elsewhere. But like for each of those things, we're just really trying to make it so that it's clear where to go to find what. But it's just really hard. None of those companies that I mentioned, like they all put a lot of thought and effort into this. It's just, I think it's just really difficult to manage all of that knowledge in a way that's accessible.
You know, I don't have an answer for this. So, I mean, we just moved from Help Scout to Zendesk from a knowledge base perspective and a help desk perspective. And part of that was changing how we do all of our help docs. And we have a different use case because we chose to break it down by if you're using Castos with WordPress or if you're using Castos by itself, because all of that is different. You know, all the screenshots and all the workflows and all that are different. So like for us, that made sense. And then within, it's basically we have two sets of knowledge documents. So that's like the first view that people get. I agree. I mean, I think that like refine, it's like a product almost. So people come in and say, you know, hey, I'm using WordPress or I'm not using WordPress. But even then, it's kind of like product where you want it to be as simple as possible, but still, you know, effective in solving people's problems. And I mean, we frankly, you know, Kim on our team spends a lot of time reviewing and iterating our help docs. But we've seen like a good result from that. It is like people are emailing less and using help docs more. So like it's been time well spent, I think, but there's not a right answer, you know, and it's really, really challenging, I think.
I really feel like this is going to be our challenge for the next several months, at least, is finding ways to just get things in order so people can help themselves better. But also I think our biggest issue around churn, there's a handful of it. It's like part of it is product. There's some features people want that we don't yet have. So we're moving forward there. But it's strategy. And what I'm really looking to do with this kind of creating this curriculum is I want to have a sort of step-by-step process that people can follow to approach DFS if they're just getting started. And that way our support team can answer questions in similar ways and have an opinionated stance on, as you're getting started, here is the best way to approach X, Y, and Z. As you get more comfortable with that, you can look into deviating from that a little bit, but like keeping things simple, trying not to get people overwhelmed with everything, and just giving them a path to follow, I feel like will be pretty big in just getting them over that hump. But yeah, it's just going to take a ton of iterating to get there.
I think that's another good like point of differentiation is there are help docs that I think should be like technically you push this button and this button and this button. And then there's success and educational things, which for me are during the trial or even before people start, you know, put this in front of people so that they can be successful. And I mean, that you can't, I think we can't get in front of people early enough because, you know, it instills trust and helps them achieve the thing they're trying to achieve and, you know, is a good marketing resource. So like, I think that's kind of the line in our team. Those are two different people. So yeah.
This is going to be pivoting in a completely different direction, but I wanted to bring up something that you had mentioned before. And actually you dug into it a little bit more on Startups for the Rest of Us with Rob, which you were just on, and it's building out a mobile app or mobile apps. And you're doing that. So I'm curious, one, to just hear more about the reasoning behind it. And then two, to just hear about like how you're actually doing that, because you're using an offshore team, which I think is really interesting. And so I'd just love to just get like a quick context on it. We can just dive into what that process looks like.
Yeah. So we're building a cross-platform mobile app. We're using React Native for it. And so React Native, you know, one code base, but works on iOS and Android. And we're building a mobile app that is only for private podcasting. which is what Rob and I talked about on the show, but right, private podcasting, like as opposed to this show where, you know, we want everyone to listen because it's, you know, entertainment and educational, hopefully, like private podcasting, and maybe we would have a private podcast, would be like, you only want certain people to listen. So like, you know, MicroConf and Rob is a good example. They could have like the MicroConf premium or Startups or the Rest of Us Select whatever podcast that maybe people have to pay for, and they can run that through like a membership platform like Memberspace, or just as a standalone thing, people sign up and get added and have like a unique feed and everything. The problem that we ran into, or the opportunity, I guess, we ran into is one, like the process of like copying this feed and going into Overcast or Apple Podcast and adding it or whatever is like three or four steps. And there's just absolutely no technical way to simplify it more than that. Like we've done a ton of work to make it as easy as possible. But there are a lot of people that don't listen to podcasts that are being added to private podcasts because they're part of a membership community or a course, or their company is rolling out private podcasting like internally just for employees, and they're not like podcast listeners. They don't, you know, they have Apple Podcasts on their phone, but have never used it. And so we say, you know, hey, what if, you know, we had a kind of native experience? You know, we can do a lot more with things like analytics and controlling who has access to things if there's not this feed URL that theoretically anybody could share and abuse. So, you know, it's analytics, it's access, and it's a little bit of like ease of use for the listeners that we decided to do it in addition or kind of like instead of or alongside the concept of like a private feed.
Will this be Castos branded, or will it be white labeled for like, say I sign up and I want to offer my subscribers a private podcast? Do they get my app, or do they download your app and somehow add the feed?
Yeah. So for our kind of like corporate customers, it can be white labeled. So it okay. can be the, you know, Drip podcast app, right? For kind of non-enterprise customers, it's the Castos app, and it'll be available in the iOS and Android Google Play Store.
Okay. And I kind of jumped the gun by saying that, yeah, you're working with an offshore team on this. Can you just talk about the decision around that versus trying to hire someone in-house to do it? What did that process look like?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, like Jonathan from our team pretty quickly, like our lead developer pretty quickly said, like, I don't know how to do this. No one else on the teams knows how to do this. Like we have all the backend and the APIs already built. It's just that this player, quote, just needs to hook into those. And so, you know, I had known Victor from Trust Shoring. So Trust Shoring is like a kind of matchmaking agency service that connects companies with Eastern European developers and agencies. And Victor hooked us up with the team from Flexum that we're using, and they're great. They're great. The nice thing is like all they do is React Native, right? So like they don't have to explain what we're doing. They say, yep, understand. We designed it all in-house and kind of built the specs out, and then they implemented it. And I mean, in that respect, it's been a really good experience because it's like really far out of our wheelhouse. You know, like we're a Laravel app and, you know, PHP for WordPress. So like JavaScript and React, like we do a little bit of in WordPress actually, but not React Native and not mobile apps and not mobile kind of UX, which I think is even more important than like web UX, just because like the real estate's so small, you know? So yeah, I mean, and like we're gonna keep working on it, but like the majority of the time and financial investment will be up front, you know? And then from there we'll spend, you know, say 10 or 20 hours a month on it, maybe. But the effort has been, you know, in the past couple of months, you know, a pretty solid effort of a developer working on this to get it going.
What will maintenance look like?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the same team will be responsible for maintaining it. Okay. I don't have any concept of what we'll need to do to maintain it on an ongoing basis.
Have you, like, do you have an agreement for, do they get a retainer? Is it just as needed? They will do fixes. What does that look like from like a technical perspective?
It's just an hourly kind of basis that we've been working on. And I mean, they've been working full time on it for a couple months, and we're about ready to launch. And then they'll go into kind of just maintenance, and we have some kind of V2 things we want to work on. So maybe they'll do more than the, you know, kind of 10 or 20 hours a month for a while to get those other few things that we want to do that didn't have to be in the first version. But then I think from there it will be bug fixes and small improvements and stuff like that. And they'll just be on an hourly basis. So, you know, it's an agency that kind of works like a contractor. So agency, nice that they have all the QA and infrastructure built in, a little more expensive, but super easy to use and onboard and everything. So
did you even consider hiring like a React Native developer just to join the team to own this? Or was the thinking that once it's built, it really won't need enough active development to have a full-time developer on it?
Yeah, I mean, we looked at a few, and I think the difference with this versus something else is, like, one, it's kind of totally separate from the rest of what we do, you know? So, like, we should be able to just take a month off from this and not need any help. So, like, having someone on retainer or something would be kind of harder to manage, I think. Hiring an agency, because it is so separate, just seemed to make more sense. And they were better, you know, than the individual developers that we kind of talked to.
After, I know the process isn't done, but at this far in, are there things you would have done differently? Or think if you took on a project like this again, you could be a little bit more efficient or effective with?
I think the one thing that we underestimated a little bit actually was what I mentioned and kind of glossed over before, is like, oh, we have the back end set up and all the APIs, the app just needs to talk to it. Of course, there are things that we had to expand, like we're using a magic link to authenticate the subscribers into the app. So they go and they enter their email, they receive a magic link in their email, and then click on it, opens the app and shows them all the podcasts that they're subscribed to, or, you know, kind of eligible to receive. And like that, none of that existed. And so that's kind of like been a holdup, is like, technically that's, you know, it's just not something we've done before. And so it's just been kind of a thing that we've had to kind of work around, is kind of expanding our API to allow for this. And so I think that is the risk or the downside of like an agency that's not part of your team, and then your team having to interface with the agency, and they're, you know, to whatever degree, like a little further removed than the folks that you have like more full time or on a regular basis. It's not been a negative thing from their perspective, from Flexum's perspective, but from ours almost, that like workflow and communication and stuff is just a little different with us working on this with them than us being able to kind of run everything internally. So yeah, I mean, I think time, like turnaround time and responsiveness is just different, but I think the rest of the benefits are, you know, kind of outweigh that.
And so when those things would come up, would it be one of your developers would basically have to drop what they're doing to go unblock the agency? Or is there someone who's kind of already internally owns part of this project, or how did that work?
Yeah. So, I mean, we've had someone, and like that person has changed over the course of the project, but yeah, a person is kind of the point person on our end of like, hey, you know, we need to build these things and enable the React team to do their thing. And I think that's nice, you know, have a person that is responsible for this. We try to have, you know, some redundancy of like other people need to know what the hell is going on, so that, you know, if that person's sick or on vacation or whatever, they can step in. But yeah, I think it's always good just to have a person who's kind of responsible for this kind of thing.
What is the rest of the team working on as far as development goes? Because this is one of the things that, again, I know we have touched on this in the show, but you talked about it a bit more in your interview with Rob about just how you've been focused a bit more on cleaning things up rather than new features. And it seems like bringing in an agency is a great way to sort of have your cake and eat it too, where your internal team can be kind of cleaning things up and this external team can move forward on something that doesn't as directly impact the code. But is that sort of what the split has looked like, or am I kind of misreading that?
No, I think that like with respect to the mobile app, that's definitely it is, right? Like the mobile app is just like additive to our production capacity. You know, our development capacity is like they're like another developer. We just kind of add in. But yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen is, and it's really been like new additions to the team have brought this like influence of, you know, hey, let's spend some time on cleaning up the front end of this. Or hey, you know, we get, you know, a couple of these support requests a week. Why does this happen? Let's figure this out so it never happens again. One, so that customers are not pissed and frustrated. Two, so that support doesn't have to deal with this. So like, it's just been a lot of little things like that that has been like, not certainly not most of our time, because we're definitely building big features still, but some of our development time has been dedicated to kind of these, yeah, cleaning up improvements, refactorings, you know, for the last couple months, really. And yeah, it's been a good process. I think it's like a pendulum that swings a little bit. It's like you spend some time getting things really tuned up. And really for us, it's like part of the team is doing that. And the other part is building this big feature. And then, you know, the big feature goes out and I think everybody will be kind of taking a break to kind of let that sink in and kind of regroup from there. But yeah, that's how it's been, I guess.
How did you know the pendulum had swung back the other way? Is it truly just, all right, big release, let's now kind of back off on the new development, clean things up, then get going again? Or was it something different that made you realize, okay, we can put more resources behind these little things? So that's just something that we struggle with a lot, is prioritizing bug fixes and smaller cleanup versus the bigger new features and functionality. I feel like I don't think we're quite ready yet to pull someone or a few people off even a decent chunk of the time, when to me, they're just sort of pretty big things that I think we're missing. And did you just feel a few months ago that you're at a spot where like, all right, like there's still more we want to build, but it's not as urgent, or how did you navigate that decision?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we just hired two new developers, and I think it was bringing them on that allowed us to pull some of our focus off of new features to make these improvements. So like we can stay building new features at about the same rate, but we also have, you know, some of these new resources working on, you know, just making the whole experience better for everybody. And at some point, those new developers, it's also kind of a nice way to onboard somebody, right? Like the first few weeks of onboarding the new developers, we had created like a milestone in GitHub, and it just had a bunch of, you know, bugs and small improvements in it. And so like they kind of know, hey, my first month is this world. And so like that, I think, has been nice for them to say like, okay, I'm going to touch different parts of the app and the code base in different ways. All of these are like things that take, you know, a couple of days or a week, typically aren't like mission critical, but are, you know, handy things to have fixed. And from there, hopefully like now one of them is rolling into like our big new feature and he has more confidence saying like, okay, I have done things. I have production code out there, you know, like I have contributed and hopefully now I'm more comfortable, you know, working on features.
Yeah. That's what I'm debating in my head. Is part of me, well, a lot of me wants to hire more to move faster on the bigger features, but I also know that that's not always realistic. Like with some of the features that we're trying to build at this point, most of them are pretty deeply integrated to like our core product. And I think it'd be very difficult to just get someone in and like, oh, build this new thing that requires you to understand how everything else works. And then it's saying, okay, like what if we get them up to speed on by doing some cleanup work? But then it's like, how much is it going to distract our other developers to help onboard them? And will that slow us down on those bigger features that I still really want to have out before football? And yeah, I don't know. It just seems like I just don't even know where to go next with these hires, because I just don't want to slow things down, but I know we need more capacity. And I just feel like that's always kind of the battle with hiring.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have the ability to hire, well, obviously more developers is always better. Like I do think that like getting people in to do some of the smaller things and cleanups and bug fixes and even refactoring, you know, like if Matt, your, you know, kind of lead guy, is saying like, this thing just always bugs me, I've never had time to go fix it, like a new developer come in, Matt explain, hey, this is how this thing works, but I want it to work like this. Like, yeah, I think that's a good way to bring somebody in. We also have like a buddy you know, for each of our new hires. And so they work really closely with the more tenured, you know, senior developer to say like, hey, you know, so the senior person can say, hey, when you're doing this thing, hey, pay attention over here and look over there. And this is how this thing works. So they're not coming in with, you know, with no idea what's going on.
That makes sense. I guess on that note too, like at this point in the company, how are you looking at finances to determine when you can or can't make a hire? It's 'cause I just feel like it gets, we're not on the true VC track where we expect to burn through the money in 18 months and we're going to be start raising in 12 and this and that. Like, but we do have some extra cash that we are okay burning through. So how are you navigating that?
Yeah, I mean, so right now we're burning a little bit every month. And I kind of just look at our growth rate and say, like, is there a thing we could do to accelerate our growth rate? And do we have the money or could we get the money to do that easily? And so, like, one of those things, and this is a whole tangent that maybe we'll talk about next episode, we made an offer and it was accepted for a head of growth. So like a pretty senior marketing person, because, you know, we're pursuing, you know, all sorts of additional financial resources into the company right now. And like, can talk about that more in a couple of episodes maybe. And like, you know, something will work out there, you know, like whether it's equity or debt, like we will get more money in the company. But even if we don't, we have enough money to bankroll this person coming in. You know, basically this person will come in and add to our growth before we round up money. Even if nothing else happens, all of this other, you know, financial stuff is just around more of that. And so that's generally how we look at it. It's like, if we bring in this person and this resource or something like the podcast we acquired, can that turn into a cash flow positive thing for us, you know, in a short amount of time?
Even on the simplest level, like where are you actually looking to see, okay, this is our burn. This is what we're actually this is what's coming in each month. These are the fees. This is our costs. Like, are you like in QuickBooks? Are you in, where are you going to, like, at the simplest level, to see where those numbers are?
Yeah. So it's really basic. So I look at, so we do like a monthly update to Tiny Seed and investors and a few kind of friends and advisors. And so I always have those to look at of like, okay, this was MRR last month, this MRR this month. And then I go and chase and look at like, this is how much money we have in the bank on the first of each month. I mean, maybe it's me, but I find that the financial modeling gets really complicated after that, because like we had people join the team this month, but we haven't paid them yet because they get paid on the first. And so like all of it, so like I just have to take a single point in time, because throughout the month is much more complicated than that. And basically say like, okay, how much money do we have in the bank now? How much do we have last month at this time? Because everything else should be kind of the same, you know, the first of the month versus the first of last month. And then how much did we grow? Are we kind of on track to kind of bring that dip back up? And how much money do we have in the bank? You know, how much of that cushion do we have? That's all that I do. How do you do it?
Not very scientifically. No. So like what I'll do is, because the trouble that I have with like looking at the MRR number is that's, I believe it's before fees. And then it's also with annual plans accounted for in the cash not made. It's not like a, you're not getting that much money each month. So I honestly just use a spreadsheet and I'll kind of add some like fudge number of like, okay, like we're probably going to be X percent below this of what we're actually getting as far as cash flow. And I think ProfitWell does have a cash flow number, which is helpful. But then, yeah, then it's just like in a spreadsheet. I'll be like, okay, like here's what I think we're spending. Here's what we're, what we have on X, Y, and Z, then our employee costs. The hard part for us has just been servers. It's been relatively unpredictable. We had been on a good path for a bit, and then some change we made like a month ago was causing like an extra probably $300 to $400 a day. And it took like, this was my bad. Yeah. It took me like a solid week, maybe a little longer to actually notice, because I just hadn't been, I don't check that closely after we've made some big improvements to our server costs, just didn't check super closely each week. It'd be like, I would just see whenever Google Cloud would bill us 10K, because that was like the limit where they'll just charge us off that. And then it was like came a little quicker. And so I looked, I was like, oh shit. All right. So like we're getting that under control, but like it's still just like variable. And then we're signing up for different services and we have contractors coming in. and it's just like hard to get too precise about it. But I want to do a better job of that just as we continue hiring, just making sure that we're not getting too far ahead of ourselves, but also like that we're not going slower than we need to. It's just, that's, yeah, kind of the challenge I'm in right now.
Yeah. I mean, if you really want to geek out on it, I would use Summit, right? Like Matt Winsink's, like,
yeah.
I, of course, I have an account because he's a tiny seed guy, but like I go in and it's just like, for me, too much. Like I don't know. I have other things that I have to do. And like, we're not going to raise $5 million and we're not, you know, we don't have a $50,000 a month burn rate. So like, it kind of doesn't matter, right? Like we're operating pretty bootstrapped right now and are hiring in a, you know, kind of bootstrapped way, but with like maybe short injections of money or something like, but not that are going to totally change our trajectory, you know? And if we did, it's just one time and we raise money or we get debt or whatever, and we will go spend it over the next 18 months because otherwise we're kind of bootstrapped.
Yeah. A lot to think about as always. I hope listeners didn't mind the tangents I brought us on, but I kind of, yeah, I, after hearing that interview with Rob, there were just a lot of things I wanted to dig into a bit with more with you. So I hope people found it helpful, but yeah, if people have any questions, they can always reach out to Greg's podcast at seekingscale.com. What is
it? That's it. Yep.
Ooh, I got it. All right. So yeah, shoot us an email. Let us know if you have any questions, any comments, anything at all. And as always, it's been fun catching up, Craig.
Awesome. Thanks, Andy.
All right. See everybody.